Our moderator tonight is Phil Haslinger. He is the contributing editor for the Capital Times. He is going to introduce the speakers tonight for you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll put it back on. Thanks, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be here tonight and to be part of this ongoing discussion. I think those of you who looked at the publicity for this know that the series is looking at how doubt plays a role both in faith and in science, in religion and science. And this is a setting in which people can raise questions about both aspects of that. I'm not going to do long introductions of either of these folks because I think they're familiar in many ways, but let me just say a couple of words about them. Richard Davidson has been doing research on the brain and on meditation for a number of years. He graduated from Harvard, came to Madison in 1985, so he's been part of this community for a long time. He got involved with the Dalai Lama and studying meditation and Buddhist monks in the early 1990s. He describes himself as someone who is drawn to Buddhism and someone who's been practicing meditation for a long time. His research has been on the work of the brain, on meditation, and has established one of the leading brain research programs in the world. He also conveniently managed to get on the cover of Madison Magazine this month, which was great publicity for tonight's program. We're aware a number of folks here have questions about some aspects of his research and involving how monkeys are used in it, and we'd be happy to address that during the question and answer session. Steve Fortney is one of the people who helped organize this series of programs. He is a Buddhist initiate, a long-time interest in Buddhism, which is sort of interesting for someone who's the son of a Lutheran pastor, suggesting that he's had an interesting evolution in his life. Long-time teacher in the Stoughton school system, also was on the Stoughton City Council for a long period of time, worked particularly in the areas of gifted and talented. He is also a published poet and novelist, so touches many different bases. Tonight, the way they've sort of divided the universe is Richard will talk about the world of science, Steve will talk about the world of literature, and you all will be invited to join the conversation as it goes along. So, Richard.
Thank you all very much for turning up on a dreary night just before Thanksgiving. I know you all got these leaflets, which I will directly address as the first question. Since you didn't come for that, I want to start by giving a little autobiography about my evolution as a scientist and how I got to the place I am. From very early on, I had a passion regarding the study of the mind and the transformation of the mind, because it was my intuition that if we really can change our minds and transform ourselves in that way, that was a very effective vehicle for changing the world. And if we wanted to make the world a better place, we really needed to start with ourselves and embody those qualities that we wish to change in others. And so from very early on, I had the conviction that something regarding the study of the mind was really in my future. And I went on to the areas of psychology and brain research. And when I was a graduate student in the mid-1970s, I actually went off to India for the first time. This was in 1974. And I spent 3 months in India and in Sri Lanka. And I got my first taste then of intensive meditation. It was there that I participated in my first intensive meditation retreat, being silent for several weeks and practicing very intensely 15 to 16 hours a day. And I came back. First of all, I came back. My professors at Harvard thought I would never come back. That was the first important accomplishment, I think. But I came back with the conviction that I had tasted something very, very important. And I actually began to dabble in research on meditation in the early part of my career. And there were two things that were very formidable obstacles. that prevented me from pursuing that work for quite some time. One was that the experiences that I was having as a practitioner were extremely rich, and they were complex and fulfilling, and I felt that the scientific methods of the day that we had available were just insufficient to capture the qualities that I was experiencing as a practitioner. And so I really didn't want to be doing pedestrian research on meditation. If I did research, I wanted it to be something I felt proud of and meaningful, and I just felt like the methods of the day were not sufficient to capture that. The second issue was a very pragmatic one. I was told by many of my colleagues that if I wanted a career in science, this was not what I should be doing. And so those two things combined to essentially steer me on a path that maintained my personal interest and involvement in meditation, but it was something that I very much kept under the rug, very few people knew about my interest in meditation. In fact, I think it's fair to say that when I was hired here at the University of Wisconsin, in 1985, probably not a soul knew about my interest in meditation, unless they really scrutinized my CV, because I actually had published a couple of papers on the topic that used the term meditation in the title many years before. Fortunately, there are lots of other publications on other topics that drew attention away from it. So, all that changed in 1992. In 1992, I received an invitation from the Dalai Lama to meet with him in India at his house and to talk about the possibility of developing a research program to investigate the minds and brains of Tibetan Buddhist monks who spent years cultivating their mind. And at first I thought that this invitation was not for real. And it was a fax that I received when I verified that this was indeed the real thing. Off I went to India to see the Dalai Lama. That was in 1992. And that was an extremely powerful and career-changing meeting for me. I made a commitment to the Dalai Lama at that meeting and to myself that now was a time for me to come out of the closet. And to talk very publicly about my interest in this area and to begin to actively do research in that area. A lot had changed in the scientific community. There were methods that were available now that were not available earlier that enabled us to look at the mind and the brain in much more detailed ways that I felt honored the experiences and transformations that were being cultivated by these practices. And so we began to seriously investigate these issues, and then in 2001 we began what I consider to be one of the more remarkable projects in which I've been engaged as a practicing scientist for 30 years, and that is we began to bring long-term practitioners, mostly from Asia, to Madison to participate in research in our lab. We've been flying monks and other practitioners, they're not all monks, by now roughly half our sample of long-term practitioners are actually lay practitioners, and about a third of them are women. But they all have the following in common. They have dedicated a minimum of 10,000 hours of formal practice in their life to training their mind. 10,000 hours is a fairly large number if you go and do the arithmetic. The range of practice in our sample goes from about 12,000 to 62,000 hours of practice. These are all what we might think of as the experts in these traditions, kind of the Olympic athletes of meditation, who have just spent a long, long time cultivating certain qualities. And this was a very important sample because it helped us define the limits of human transformation, the kind of possibility that can accrue from such systematic training. Now, there is a tradition in the brain sciences as well as in psychology for looking at expertise. We know, for example, that musical training is something that often begins early in life, and we know that the more one practices, typically, in most cases, the better one gets. These are skills which can be cultivated. Similarly, any kind of complex sport, tennis or golf, or most other kinds of sports, are the kind of activity which benefit from practice. They're skills which can be cultivated. And we have conceptualized the work that we do within the general framework of what is called neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is probably the most important discovery in the neurosciences in the last decade. And what neuroplasticity refers to is the fact that the brain can change in response to experience and in response to training. More than any other organ in our body, it's built to change in response to experience. And so we can think of certain qualities like compassion, like altruism, like happiness, more as skills which can actually be trained. Most middle-class Americans believe today that physical exercise is something that's good for their health. And many middle-class Americans have incorporated some kind of exercise routine into their week. Well, imagine what the world would be like if we thought of mental exercise in the same way as we think of physical exercise, and if we incorporated in our daily or weekly life systematic practice of certain kinds of mental skills, like the cultivation of these virtuous qualities. There is every reason to believe, from what we know in modern neuroscience, that we would actually be changing circuits in the brain, we would be changing the function of the brain, we would be changing the structure of the brain in ways that modern science tells us would be beneficial to our psychology, to our interpersonal relationships, to many things in our life, and even to our physical health. Some of the work we have been doing has been looking at the relation between brain function and changes that take place in what we call peripheral biology, that is biology below the neck, which is important for health and illness. And while I certainly wouldn't want you to leave with the idea that I'm advocating meditation as a treatment for all kinds of physical conditions, there are some physical disorders which clearly would benefit from these kinds of practices based on the kind of evidence that we have. So there are changes that we've seen in immune function, there are changes that we see in endocrine function, all in the direction of improved health and improvements in systems that are often elevated in response to the stress of daily life. And in meditation practice, we see an improved balance in these physiological systems. So I want to just also say that I find my involvement in meditation, in my profession as a scientist, to be extraordinarily compatible. And since the topic of this lecture series is on faith and reason, or something like that, I wanted to just address that issue. Both the great wisdom traditions in the world, as well as science, are interested in understanding the true nature of reality. And science has a set of tools for becoming as honest an observer as we possibly can become of nature. And in the same way, practices like meditation cultivate a kind of radical honesty about our perceptions of the world. And when science is done right, and and contemplative practice is done in the way, I think, in which the great wisdom traditions have advocated. The two great ways of knowing the world really are, I think, importantly compatible. And so the quality of honesty, I think, that underlies each of them really is the same when they are practiced in the way that they have been intended. I think that there has been a lot made in the popular press about the irreconcilable issues between science and religion, but I think when you look at the spiritual core of a lot of the great religious traditions, there really is quite a lot of overlap in important ways between these traditions, the spiritual traditions, and between science. So let me just say a little bit more now about the specifics of the work that we've been doing in our lab to provide a little bit more background and context. In addition to the research that we've been doing in these very long-term practitioners, one of our goals is to see the extent to which these kinds of practices help ordinary people who are rank amateurs, who are complete novices, and whether even short-term training of this kind makes a difference. I often get the question from people that, you know, I talk about these long-term practitioners. Some of them have been meditating for 30, 40, 50,000 hours. This is completely unrealistic for the average layperson. Each of the long-term practitioners in our study has actually been to at least one three-year retreat. And in a three-year retreat, they practice for at least 10 hours a day, 365 days a year for three continuous years. And so most people don't check out for 3 years and go off to a retreat and be completely off the grid. These are a very unusual group of people in having all done that. So one question that we've turned our attention to is, can really short-term training make a difference? And one of the commitments that I've made to the Dalai Lama and to myself is that I would try to bring the study of compassion to mainstream science. That there is absolutely no reason why we can't use the same rigor that we use to study fear and disgust and anxiety to the study of qualities like happiness and compassion. And so we've been engaged in a study now that we're actually still in the midst of, where we are determining if just 2 weeks of practicing for 30 minutes a day in people who've never practiced before, a very specific practice that's designed to cultivate compassion. And we've asked whether we can actually see changes that are produced in the brain with just 2 weeks of practice. And the answer seems to be dramatically yes. And the amazing thing is that we see the changes in exactly the same places in the brain that we see in our very long-term practitioners. The changes are not nearly as great, but they are reliable, detectable, and significant. We don't know how long they're going to last, and of course it's our hope that even though the experiment ended after 2 weeks of practice, that we've given people something that they can take with them forever and keep practicing. I suspect that just as in the case of physical exercise, if you stop practicing, changes that are not going to last forever, and you need to keep practicing to enjoy the benefits being continuous. But the study was a very encouraging study in showing that even this incredibly short period of time can make a huge difference in terms of what we can see in the brain. 2 weeks, 30 minutes a day. And moreover, we actually developed the compassion practice in a way that we delivered it on the web. And so people actually logged on to a protected website and actually received the instruction over the web. I can tell you that I'm now in active discussions with Google, and Google is extremely interested in all of this, and they are now launching a major study which I'm helping to direct with Google employees at their world headquarters to look at the impact of meditation, and it's going to be delivered over the web. And needless to say, this is something that Google is quite interested in. It has the means to deliver this to billions of people if the initial findings prove to be prove to hold up. And so I think that there's tremendous possibility here for freely conveying to very large segments of the population these kinds of methods, which really are quite simple, and even a little bit of time clearly can make a big difference. So I'm going to end here. I really don't need to speak for more than this initial 20 minutes, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues, and there'll be plenty of time for questions and answers. Thank you very much.
Well, that was wonderful. And what I would like to do is to talk briefly about an entirely different approach, less important, I think, to this evening's discussion, so that we can get to the questions that you probably want to get to in terms of looking into Richard's researches. My point of... Okay, this thing on?
It's on.
It's on.
Okay, is that better? I'm still fighting that cold that I had last week, and a little weakness in the vocal cords. I will start off with an autobiographical note as well, and that is that as some of you were here last week, did hear that my background has been, to say the least, mobile. My father was a military man. He was a chaplain during World War II. We moved on an average of once every 8 months during a 10-year period from 1939 to 1949. Then he left the regular army and became a civilian minister in the Lutheran Church. And we moved on every 2 years, and sometimes within the town a couple of times, too. So I'm a completely deracinated, ruthless human being. And as a consequence of that, my brothers and I particularly lived a pretty rich inward life. It was more or less independent of our surroundings at the time, and it was not, it shouldn't be terribly surprising that my two brothers and my sister have gravitated toward the arts, the inward life and creativity and all that kind of thing, rather than becoming local politicians and deeply rooted in a single place. However, I will say that when I finally got my job in Stoughton, Wisconsin, I decided in that house they're going to carry me out, and I'm not moving another goddamn inch. And that's exactly basically what's happened. I've been down there for a long period of time. As a consequence of that deracination, that rootlessness, rather than going into a study of meditation as a more or less deliberate choice for the purpose of cultivating the experiences that are available to one there, my whole background has been completely accidental. There's a section in the book that Marsh and I wrote dealing with a main character of Thomas Mann by the name of Buddenbrooks. And the passage describes Buddenbrooks as one time laying in bed and all of a sudden having one of these enormously interesting experiences that I think, you know, any Buddhist or Hindu would recognize as a Kensho experience, a religious experience where he sensed his unity of the, with the entire universe and his vitality as a human being that could possibly come out of it. But like a typical German and a typical Westerner, he woke up the next morning and wondered what strange thing had happened to him. And he decided, well, this is ridiculous, this is silly. And he did his best and successfully, quite successfully so, to forget that experience and lead his normal life as a middle-class Burgermeister. Well, as Richard has said, in science, the meditation was a marginal thing. In our own religious tradition, the meditative tradition is also marginal. There is a rich wisdom tradition that has grown out of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But in the earliest years, these have been, as I say, marginalized. It is pushed off to the side. Some of the practitioners have even been accused of heresy. Some of them have been executed. Halaj in the 9th century, the 10th century, for example, is a good example of that. Some of the early medieval mystics were in fact relegated to the dungeons of their own monasteries and so on and so forth. This is not true of the East. The East has mysticism as more or less normative. That's where you begin, that's how you start. In the West, if you are a mystic, and I'm using the word mystic in a more or less technical sense, in the sense that one is entertaining the mysteries, which is where the word mystery actually comes from, or the word mystic is they have a common root, that those who entertain the mysteries didn't, in fact, have subdivisions within each of the three major religions, the Hesychast tradition, in the Orthodox tradition, the Sufi expression in Islam, and of course in the Christian mystics as well. Mysticism in the common parlance is superstition. Carl Sagan used it that way. Anything that was superstitious to him was mystical. Now this is not what I mean, this is not what a lot of the writers on the subject mean. I'm thinking particularly of a man by the name of Jiananda Bharati, whose real name was Leopold Fischer. He was a Viennese whose mother was Indian, and he became a professor of tantric and Buddhist studies, I think at one of the New York universities. Tantric Hindu, actually, is what he was, and very much of a troublemaker. In any case, he wrote a book called Light at the Center, The Context and Pretext of Modern Mysticism. This is a book that I would recommend to all of you because it does, in fairly clear terms, describe what the mystical event is all about. Now, I mentioned to you that I tend to have come to this tradition as a matter of accident. Having no roots, having a rich inward life as children, my brothers and I, it was not impossible that we would, on a fairly regular basis, and I can testify to that myself, experience non-ordinary realities, meditative situations, and all the rest of it. I never knew what it was. I had no idea. But it was just sort of the normal way that my brothers and I lived. Well, at a certain point, it came to a head in 1968 when my brother, who was my youngest brother, who was a pacifist, a conscientious objector, still went into the army, and in 1968 was killed in Vietnam. 2 years later, or 2 months and 2 days later, my father died, so I lost a quarter of my family all at once, and this put me into a relatively negative state of mind, as you might guess. In 1975, I found myself in a meditative group here in Madison. It was a Hindu group. I was just getting started with it. And then I underwent a series of long, intense meditations that, in fact, as Richard has said, changed the mind. It, in fact, did that. Under the circumstances, I made a note of that, but then I began to work more and more seriously in literary productions, in poetry particularly, and in novels as well. And it began to occur to me as I made my study in these areas that in addition to wisdom and science as ways to the truth, so also is art. And what I have tried to think through since my discipline now is two things. How to write a good sentence, that's one thing, that's harder than you might think. And the other thing is synthesis, how to synthesize the variety of materials that have come to me. And I look at art, and I look particularly at the tragic traditions, and I begin to see a relationship between the states of mind that are created in the expression of high art, as well as being very similar to the states of mind that are created in higher states of meditation. As what has been called as an accidental Buddhist, completely accidental. Of course, my father, as a Lutheran minister, would be a little surprised at what his son is doing these days. As I said last week, I tend to think of Buddhism as a reform movement within the Hindu religion, like the Lutheran Church is a reform movement within the West, and so therefore Buddhism is sort of the Lutheran Church of Asia. That's how I justify that. Well, you know, being Norwegian and being from Wisconsin and of Lutheran background, that's my rationale. But at any rate, I begin to notice the congruence of these states of mind that are produced in the viewing of high tragedy, particularly. I would dare say that a good portion of you go out to APT, right? Can I see some hands about APT? You bet. It's a miracle out there. It's wonderful stuff. The last Lear I saw was with Randall Duck Kim. This is some years ago. I hope they do it again, because live Lear, well done, is something not to be missed. And when you watch that play, and when you read it, when you audit the play, you find some peculiar states of mind begin to emerge that are just as changing, just as creating a plasticity of the mind, as Richard has said, as meditation itself does. Now, I tend to think of the Kensho experience, the Enlightenment experience, by accident, one powerful one occurred to me, as being part of an aesthetic range. Satchitananda, knowledge, wisdom, and bliss. The bliss is certainly a part of this, the emotional part of it, is part of the characteristics, the mental characteristics that attend the religious experience. And I noticed also in watching Great Lear, and particularly Kim's version of it, and then Sir Laurence Olivier on television in the 80s, I think it was, tremendously moving stuff, that the same attributes that you have attending a high religious experience, a high Kensho experience, also attends high art. And if it doesn't do it in music for you, you know, the best of the music, Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart, all the rest of that, being Lutheran, of course, Bach has to be there. Papa Bach is there. If you don't see it in great things like this, then you have to kind of rediscipline yourself to an understanding of the musical process and a way to experience the kind of things that the musicians and the artists are attempting to do for you. Now, I just want to mention Lear specifically and very briefly. You know the play. Lear, the old man, has decided to retire. He wants to divest himself of his kingdom. And as a consequence, he wants to divide his kingdom into three parts between his three daughters, Regan, Daniel, and Cordelia. As an old fool, he asks his daughters to bribe him with expressions, great expressions of their great love for him. This is the play, I'm sure you know this. Regan and Goneril do just exactly that. You know it's hypocritical, you know it's excessive, everybody should know it, but Lear doesn't. Then he goes to Cordelia and asks for the same thing. And she very sensibly decides that she's not going to do this. She's an honest, rational human being. And as a consequence, she says, and I have that quote from the last play here. "Unhappy that I am," she says, "I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more, no less." Well, this enrages the old man. First of all, he takes her portion, gives it to the other daughters. Then he banishes her. And then he undergoes a declension throughout the play. He visits his daughters, they take away his retainers, they remove his majesty, they remove his power, until finally he's left with nothing. He's this old foolish man raging on the heath, garlanded with flowers, in the storms, the great storm seas, and is reduced to being what he describes his fool as being, unaccommodated man. There's nothing left to him. Then in the last act, as you will recall, Lear's supporting armies have been defeated. Cordelia has tried to invade the country to rescue her father. Cordelia is captured and imprisoned. Then she is strangled by her enemies. And in the last part of that scene, Lear enters carrying his daughter. He cannot ask her blessing now, nor pray and sing or tell old tales and laugh at gilded butterflies. He carries his two lately beloved daughters in his arms, and he howls, and he howls, and he howls. How can dogs, horses, and rats have breath and life, and she no breath at all? He is so charged with grief that he asks somebody to unbutton his collar. He's choking. Do you see this? He tries to look at the supposed breathing of his dead daughter. Look on her. Look at her lips. Look there. Look there. That entire scene is written in nothing but monosyllables. It is the most powerful scene in Shakespeare, and it is one of these things that is an absolute miracle of composition. Take a look at it, check it out. But what are we left with? In the classic tragedies, the main characters are the tragic figures. They discover what their flaw was almost too late, but they become fully conscious of it. Oedipus discovers that he has been sleeping with his mother and has killed his father. Absolutely devastating insights. In Lear is never clear that Lear has been conscious enough at all to understand his own plight thoroughly. So the power of the tragedy is thrown on the audience. You see this. You see this old foolish man who could have lived with the affection of his daughters, who could have died in a prosperous kingdom and been properly buried, who is facing the worst of all disorders. And the worst of all those disorders is the fact that his child has died before he has. And he's not completely and utterly aware at his death what has happened to him. We are. So what happens? Put back on the audience, we see the tragic conflict. We see the emptiness of the rage. We see the foolishness of the ambition. And it suggests to us kind of an encounter with being itself in a certain way. Now, I'm using extravagant language to describe this, but in fact, I think it's fair enough language itself. The deeply tragic sense of life, as is true with the sense of enlightenment, cannot be reduced to language. It is a sense that you feel, a sense that you have some understanding of, but that cannot be, you cannot express it perfectly. Zero experiences, mystical experiences, epiphanies, peak experiences cannot be reduced to language. Experiences become words in the ordinary way of looking at things. Words become ideologies, ideologies, or words become concepts, concepts become ideologies, and that's the trap that we all get into. Well, as the Hindus say, Brahman is that reality from which all language turns back. The mysteries are ineffable. And it's this rich experience that Richard alluded to that is at the heart of the mystical events that, in fact, give the structures to most religious expressions. If the mystical event is aesthetic, it is part of the feeling, sense, emotion part of our minds, it is transformative, If that is the case, then what is the religion that expresses it? We like to use the image of the candle within a Chinese lantern, you know, with eight sides, different colored glass. It's the glass itself that we have made. These are human constructs. Religion, according to some writers, is a defense against a religious experience. You don't quarrel about the light, but, you know, the various panes of the glass can go to war against each other because my glass is better than your glass and mine is clearer than yours and so on and so forth. That's where the battles, religious battles, occur. If your religious outlook is fundamentally mystical in expression, then you're not going to get into too many arguments. And this is where the sense of equanimity, the sense of the wisdom tradition actually comes from. If religions are human constructs and they are a defense against a religious experience, that means all the gods that we name are basically characters in books. Yahweh and Juno and Zeus and all the rest of them are characters in books. We have a literary experience of them. If, however, you use the word God, which is a Western and unnecessarily loaded word, which I could, if I could, I would not use, but if you use the word God, on the other hand, as a metaphor for the mystery dimension of the universe, then one doesn't believe that necessarily. One experiences that presence all the time, if you are conscious of it. Thomas' Gospel says the kingdom of the Father is spread out on the earth, but men do not see it. Nirvana is here or nowhere. The sacred and the profane are now united. This is the kingdom of Buddha and the Thomas Jesus are those who wake up to see that reality as we can, if we will. Well, I think that there's a close relationship between the experiences of high art on the one hand and the Kensho experiences on the other. I can use the same language that the Hindus, as great psychologists of religion, Satchitananda, use to describe the religious experience, to describe what happens to me when I'm thoroughly auditing the lyre, when I can do that. Now, I don't do it all the time, and no one really does, but these, in fact, are kind of momentary experiences. And one of the most exciting things, and I'm going to stop here and let people get into the questioning, one of the most exciting things in the last 50 years, I would say, particularly since the end of World War II, is that now the traditions of philosophers and the mystics and the teachers and the wisdom tradition of the East is penetrating into our own culture. So now we have a virtual Noah's Ark of traditions to choose from, and how this is all going to wind up based upon the scientific study of the intranaut experience on the one hand, a continuing set of comparisons of mythology and literature on the other, how it's all going to come out is anybody's guess. We'll say, probably, that it will be novel and it will be very exciting. Well, I want to stop there and I don't want to talk to you again.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks, Richard. And we've got about 45 minutes in which we can have a broader discussion with the kinds of issues that have come up in the course of their presentations. Two very different ways of coming at an understanding of what happens in our minds as we encounter something beyond ourselves.
Steve. Thanks, Phil. I was wondering, Dr. Davidson, have you done any work with performance in sports? And, you know, as a parallel maybe to a meditator who's spent 20,000-30,000 hours, a Tiger Woods or a Roger Federer, to the extent they've trained their brain.
I will answer that question, but I made a commitment to address this leaflet first, and I will do that. So let me do that first, and then I'll come back to your question. It's actually, I think, wonderful that people know that I do some research in non-human primates. It's not the bulk of what I do, but I have done that work. I continue to do that work, and I'm proud of that work. And I really welcome the opportunity to directly address it. I've had many soul-searching discussions about this issue with myself, with my colleagues, and with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. One of the things that is really the most important issue for me is what one's motivation is to do the work that one is doing. And actually, this is something that the Dalai Lama has always asked about any kind of work. And my motivation is really to eliminate suffering. And that is why I do my science and why it's really what I'm dedicating my life to. In addition to the research that we've been doing on meditation and qualities like compassion, we also study devastating disorders like depression, which is responsible for extraordinary morbidity and mortality across the world. There are untold numbers of suicides daily in this country as a function of these disorders. A recent epidemiological study that was done in Scandinavia found that just asking people how happy or unhappy they are in a large epidemiological study predicted over a 20-year interval the extent to which a person would commit suicide, and there was a tenfold increase in suicide rates among people who reported themselves to be very unhappy. So these are issues which are really profound. They affect people's lives, and they're responsible for devastating suffering on the planet. To the extent that the work we do can help develop new interventions, which I firmly believe they can and will and are currently doing, that is something that I think is critical in this program of research. And the work that we do in non-human primates has been done with non-invasive methods to image the brain. We're actually one of the pioneers in developing methods to study the brains of non-human primates in ways which actually don't create suffering, which are the same methods that I subject myself to all the time. Modern brain imaging methods. We have one of the few systems in the world today for doing that kind of non-invasive imaging of the non-human primate brain. So I believe this work is really important. It is done with the intention of relieving suffering. I also do it in a way which I try to muster all the gratitude I can for the animals that participate in our research. And if you bring that quality to the work that you're doing, I think it transforms it. And so I appreciate the sensitivity that this issue raises. I applaud the efforts of people who are working to help relieve suffering throughout the animal kingdom, I welcome the opportunity to address this and to underscore the fact that this work is done to actually eradicate suffering on the planet. So I thank you for listening to that. Now let me take on your question. The question was about sports and the development of expertise in sports like a Tiger Woods, and whether that kind of expertise leads to the same kind of qualities that I've talked about in meditation. My intuition is that it probably leads to some of the same kinds of qualities, but not all of them. But this is something that really needs to be studied. It has not been addressed in a serious scientific way. There are certain qualities like focused attention, which I think certain kind of sports engages, that is similar to what is engaged in meditation. And I'm confident that if the right kinds of measures were obtained, you would see some commonalities. What's different, though, is that these practices are typically embedded within a very, very deep ethical framework. And the reason one practices is not to experience a momentary high, or not even to experience the bliss that you might experience when you're practicing, but rather it really is done to eliminate suffering, to reduce suffering on the planet, and to make oneself a more effective instrument in the reduction of suffering. And so that's not why Tiger Woods, I don't think, practices his golf game, or why other people in sports do what they do. And so I think that's the crucial difference.
Sports Illustrated some years ago had an article called Sport the Yoga of the West. And I'm going to agree with Richard about this, that some of the things that they talked about are similar to the kinds of things that happen in meditation. John Brody and Lynn Swan, for example, seem to communicate on a different level. This is one of the things that was described. There is a book, a biography of Russell, Bill Russell, the great center for the Boston Celtics, in which he would describe certain games where something just seemed to take over, and they could do things, you know, without any sense of time to it at all. And then after the game, this is the expression that he used, that they walked around for the rest of the day, each one of them had a golden eagle perched on their shoulders. Well, what this exactly is, of course, this is anecdotal, and it needs to be looked at in a more serious way. But there are some athletes that testify to this kind of non-ordinary reality that you may be alluding to. This is also true in heavy combat. For example, Eric Severide, in one of his books, describes a certain battle scene in the Battle of the Bulge in 1945, in which he had that same kind of odd business happen to his own mind. And in addition to that, I just learned yesterday that among the list of Hollywood celebrities who are Buddhist, Tiger Wood apparently is one of them, so I don't even know if he's operating on a different plane or not. He seems to, anyway.
Yes.
I'd like to follow up on what you just said. As far as, given the fact you're a believer involved in Buddhism and compassion and the belief that it's not right to hurt, cause pain, or kill sentient creatures, you said that you do experiments on monkeys and primates, but you do non-invasive. Well, my understanding is you've done experiments with Dr. Ned Kalin, and I know that Dr. Ned Kalin does a lot of invasive brain experiments on monkeys who are kept in cages, who are restrained for extended periods of time, whose amygdala is burned and destroyed with acid. These are sentient creatures who should be living in their natural environment. And frankly, it causes me great pain to think of their suffering.
Well, you know, thank you for that articulate statement. I can tell you that we have been pioneers in the development of non-invasive methods to image the brain. To the extent that there is suffering that occurs in the context of the research that we do, we believe that the motivations that we have for doing the research are critical to take into account. We do everything we possibly can to minimize suffering, both of the animals, the non-human animals, as well as the humans. You know, the experiments that we do in humans require a great deal of sacrifice as well. You know, we can have a very extended discussion here and take the rest of the time on this issue. I think there are probably other questions, but I think the most important thing is that is the attitude of the scientist who's doing this work, both the motivation that the scientist brings to the task, and also the extent to which gratitude is expressed in the act of doing the work that we're doing, which transforms the nature of one's relationship with the monkeys that we study. You know, I think in the best of all possible worlds, it would be wonderful to have outdoor enclosures where the animals are not living in cages. There are places where the climate permits where that kind of work can be done. It's not possible to do it here in Wisconsin because of the climate. If I had my druthers, I would much rather have that kind of facility. But given sort of the circumstances that present themselves, the opportunities, and the difference that I believe we can make in terms of treatments for dramatic suffering that exists on the planet, I'm proud of this work, and I think that the good that it does so far exceeds the minimal amount of suffering that we create. And I think that, you know, some of the comments that you made are comments that are made, frankly, for lack of knowledge of the details of this work. And if it really is of interest, you should actually look at the papers, which are all available free online, and take a careful look at what it is that's actually done.
Can I say
other questions?
I was curious if you've done any work with PTSD.
Is there another mic so we can hear what the person is asking?
I'll repeat the question.
Yeah, as far as like with all the returning military people, it seems to be a huge problem with post-traumatic stress disorder. If there's any component that can be utilized to alleviate that suffering.
The question was whether any work has been done on folks suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and whether anything in terms of brain work could help relieve that affliction.
There is work going on the impact of meditation and practices derived from the contemplative traditions in patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, and that work is really just beginning now. There are a number of groups throughout the country that have been doing it. The initial findings look extremely promising, that some of this work will be really useful. There is an amazing project which is going on in New York City now. Some of you may know from public talks that I've given that one of the major thrusts of the work that we're doing now on meditation is to think about how contemplative practices may be applicable in kids in the K through 12 years when there is increased plasticity in the brain to actually begin to cultivate some of these qualities earlier in life and to potentially prevent or minimize the likelihood of disorders like PTSD occurring. And a project is currently going on with for one of my colleagues that we're collaborating on the education work with, who is in New York City, and she's working with 27,000 New York City school kids, all of whom were personally affected by 9/11. And she has put into place a curriculum that is based on contemplative practice in with these kids, and the initial findings from it are really quite astounding. The goal of this project is called Project Renewal, and you can actually find out about it on the web. The goal of this project is to minimize the likelihood of the development of PTSD in this group that is at extremely high risk for its development. So. There are a wonderful opportunity for work in that area.
Yes, back there.
Yeah, my question is a follow-up to your study that you did over the internet. And I was wondering if you could either maybe elaborate more on actually what that study encompassed and then how you actually measure people after that study. I'm curious to know a little bit more about that.
Question was, could he tell more details about the two-week study on the internet or on compassion? And I guess I came upon was, what was the exercise that they did it? Can anybody pick that up somewhere?
Sure, they're very simple practices. The essence of the practice is derived from an amalgam of practices that are done in the Tibetan tradition as well as in the Theravadan tradition. And it's a combination of, for those of you who are familiar with these traditions, it's a combination of a compassion practice called Tongleng in the Tibetan tradition and a loving kindness or metta practice in the Theravadan tradition. And the practice simply involves visualizing a number of specific people. It may start with oneself. It often starts with oneself. Or it could start with a loved one. And you visualize them, and then you say to yourself certain phrases. And the phrases are meant not to just be said cognitively, but they're meant to be experienced emotionally. And they're phrases like, may I be free from suffering, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be healthy, may I live a life with ease. Those are the kinds of phrases. There are different phrases that can be formulated, but they all have those themes. And the individual is asked to quietly, silently repeat those phrases with these different individuals as their focus, and do that for 30 minutes a day. That's basically the essence of the practice. And for those of you who've never tried a practice like this, it may sound a little hokey at first. And I could tell you, for me, when I first started doing this practice, it was a little hokey, and it took a while for it to really congeal. It is a practice that I now do every day of my life. I've been doing it for probably 5 or 6 years, maybe more. That's what we studied in this two-week study. And you asked about how we measure these things. Well, one of the ways we measure it, you know, when you go to a cardiologist and she or he is interested in looking at your cardiovascular function, one of the things you might do is do a cardiac stress test, where you actually go on an exercise bike or on a treadmill and you challenge the heart. Well, we have a brain stress test. What we want to do is challenge the person. And what we do in the experiment is to actually present pictures of human suffering. They are pictures that you see every day in the media, but a sort of canonical picture that we've presented is a picture of a baby with a large tumor growing out of its eye. And we present people with these pictures, and it's amazing, if you present these kind of pictures to American college students, you know what the dominant emotion that people experience is? These are American college students. The dominant emotion to pictures like that is disgust. And they kind of, you know, they make a disgust facial expression, they kind of stick out their tongue and turn away. And one of the things that we're interested in is how a compassion practice changes your response to depictions of human suffering. And I could tell you that it dramatically changes the way the brain responds to those kinds of images. We ask people, so we have self-report measures, questionnaires, where they report that they experience more well-being, that they experience more compassion. One of the other really crazy things we did in this experiment is we initially did this study on Wisconsin undergraduates, and it was a multi-session experiment, and we paid people for participating, as we always do. This was a lot of sessions because people had to log on daily to do the compassion practice, and we paid people $165 for participating in this experiment, which to an undergraduate was a fairly large chunk of money. And we said at the end of the experiment that you now have an opportunity to donate any portion of the money that we're giving you, anywhere between $0 and $165, to a charitable cause of your choosing, whatever you want. And it just had to be a charitable cause where they can actually execute the transaction online. And there was no deception involved. This was for real. And they actually did make, you know, some people actually made financial contributions. And it turns out that the magnitude of change in certain parts of the brain, and this one part of the brain in particular that we find particularly activated in the long-term practitioners, when people are doing the compassion practice, that predicts how much money they actually donate when they're given an opportunity to make a charitable donation. And overall, the people who went through the compassion training compared to a control group that went through a training that's based on cognitive therapy, where they're taught to cognitively reappraise negative events, and it's used as a treatment for depression, the compassion group donated significantly more money compared to this control group. And so, you know, these are modest and surely in certain ways trivial and very incomplete ways of measuring these things, but we feel that they're a start. One of the things that we're also about to do is another kind of study that actually was stimulated by my own experience being in the presence of these long-term practitioners as well as the Dalai Lama. And it's captured by an anecdote. After one of the long-term practitioners left Madison, he was here for 4 days, and he stayed at the Intowner Hotel on Old University in Highland. It's right near our lab, so it's a convenient place for these practitioners to stay. I got a call the day after he left from the manager of the hotel, and I thought there was something screwed up with the billing because the billing was being done by the university. The manager was on the phone. And so I got on the phone, very surprised to hear from the manager, and he was calling to just express his appreciation to us for having the most wonderful people stay in his hotel. He said that three of the employees spontaneously commented that this guy was the kindest person they'd ever seen. And the woman who runs the restaurant, the person who checked them in, and the maid, all three spontaneously commented on how wonderful this guy was, and the manager was just encouraging me to have more of these people stay in the hotel. So one of the things that we're doing is having a long-term practitioner have a short interaction with a ordinary person who has never had any meditation practice to see whether just being in the presence of an individual who is exuding compassion, when they're exposed to stimuli like depictions of human suffering, whether just being in the presence of someone like that transforms how you respond. We think that it might. And so that's something that we're currently exploring.
Honey.
I'm interested to know if you think that this compassion work would naturally facilitate forgiveness. There's good research at the university also on the subject of forgiveness and the process by which forgiveness occurs. And in addition to that, your thoughts on whether or not mirror neurons have anything to do with what might enhance compassion or constrict it in some fashion, or growing them by doing compassion work, whatever.
Two different questions. One about, is there a link between the compassion studies and forgiveness studies that are going on at the university in terms of can compassion affect forgiveness? Is that a
facilitated?
And the second is neurons?
Mirror neurons. So first on the issue of forgiveness, the honest answer from a scientific perspective, I can't see you, I'm going to stand up. The honest answer from a scientific perspective is we don't know. There really hasn't been good work on the relation between compassion and forgiveness. Certainly my intuition is that it would. And so there are people who are beginning to study that now. On the issue of mirror neurons, for those of you who don't know what mirror neurons are actually something that was discovered in monkeys, but they exist in people too. Mirror neurons are a very interesting group of cells that we have in our brain that have the following property. They are cells which fire when one is engaged in a certain kind of activity, but they also, the very same neuron fires when you see another person engaged in that same activity. The way they were first discovered was actually by a guy named Giacometti Rizzolatti at the University of Parma in Italy. And he was someone studying monkeys, and he observed that certain cells in the monkey's brain that fired when the monkey reached for an object, that very same cell began to fire when an experimenter actually reached for the same object. And that was the beginning of the discovery of mirror neurons. So mirror neurons exist in the human brain, and they are found in very specific areas of the brain. They do appear to play a very important role in empathy. And so one of the things about empathy is that you, at least to some extent, in an empathic response, experience the same emotion as the individual that you're observing. And when that individual is in pain, one of the things that you see is that there are some centers in the brain that have a lot of mirror neurons that also seem to be involved with pain that respond, this is in humans, when you see another person in pain. It turns out that in our long-term practitioners, areas of the brain that are specifically activated when they're doing compassion meditation are areas of the brain that include those that are very rich in mirror neurons. And so we think that there definitely is some connection there. The details of all of that need to be worked out, but there's definitely something there, and I think that mirror neurons are an important ingredient in certain human capacities for empathy and compassion.
That showed that similar results to what you found with your long-term practitioners were also found when brains were studied of Franciscan nuns engaged in prayer, and I think also Christian monks. Can you comment on any further experimentation with that group? And the second question is, why are contemplative practices okay to be taught to thousands of New York school children when, if they were planning to teach them Christian prayer, there would be an outcry across the country?
Again, two questions. First of all, experiments that have been done with Franciscan nuns and other Christian groups engaged in meditation, and what?
Not meditation, excuse me, prayer.
Prayer. What crossover there is with that, and then if the practices for the school children in New York City involve Christian practices, there'd be an outcry. How come this is okay?
Wonderful questions. Thank you. In terms of the first question, there's a little bit of research which is beginning to be done, and let me just say at the outset that I don't believe that there's any unique feature of Buddhism that suggests that only Buddhist meditation practices are the ones which are going to cultivate these qualities. My very strong intuition is that many traditions have contemplative or prayer practices which will have very similar kinds of results. And one of the things that we've been trying to do through an organization that I'm part of called the Mind and Life Institute, which is a nonprofit organization that was founded by the Dalai Lama and several other people, that is promoting a dialogue between Western science and the contemplative traditions. It has mostly, to this day, been focused on Buddhism, but the person who actually is nudging us the most to include other traditions is the Dalai Lama. And some of you may have seen that just last week, I appeared on a panel here in Madison with Father Thomas Keating, who's an extremely well-known Christian contemplative who does work in centering prayer. And Father Thomas has been part of several dialogues that we've had also with the Dalai Lama. And from interacting with Father Thomas, I'm convinced that also I've been taught centering prayer by the head of his organization. My own experience is that it's in many ways similar to the kinds of things I experienced in, with Buddhist meditation. So I think there's a lot of commonality, and that needs to be explored. Your other question about why it's okay to do contemplative practices with 27,000 New York City school kids, but it's not okay to do Christian prayer, I think that's a bigger issue. And one of the goals of the Dalai Lama has been to secularize many of the practices that are in the Buddhist tradition to enable them to enable a much larger swath of humanity to enjoy their benefits while still being members of whatever religious tradition they may be members of, and to gain more widespread acceptance. You know, it's for the very reason that if it was framed as a Christian practice, it wouldn't be permitted in the New York City school system, that I think it's important that we secularize these practices so that there is a larger group of people that can benefit from them, and so and also to minimize the extent to which particular religious belief systems actually come in the way of individuals deriving benefit from these practices. It's my strong conviction that you don't need to have a particular religious belief to benefit from these kinds of practices. An atheist can derive as much benefit from these practices as someone who is a great believer in God. And I don't believe that there's a smidgen of difference in the benefits that they can derive from these contemplative traditions. And so I feel strongly that to increase their acceptance and to address larger segments of the population, it's going to be very important to secularize the practices.
I have a mild disagreement with that. Let me do some historical commentary first. Some years ago, there was an attempt to do some relaxation response within the physical education department at the Stone High School. And about the same time, there was some attempt to introduce meditative practices in some of the other secondary and middle schools across the country. There was a lot of objection to it from the point of view of certain people who describe this kind of relaxation response, this so-called secular practice, actually was a covert Hinduism. There was even some legal commentary on that. Now, I don't know whether or not that's all true, but there are certain presuppositions involved in meditative practice that would not find a good home at all in some of the more conservative and normative Christian churches. There's a presumption of a monism on the part of the secular and the Eastern religious practice that is not characteristic of the very conservative Christian churches in their theology. So there may be something to that. It may be something that has to be resolved. I'm not sure myself. I'm basically a practicing Buddhist who has delighted in meditation for over 30 years and found it very instructive and also found it very healing. I'm not sure that we can secularize that to the point that it would satisfy some of those more conservative groups. I just don't think that's possible.
Did you have a question before?
I was wondering what brain locations, what parts of the brain seem to be involved in different levels of meditation, and the functional MRIs, are you getting sequences of the brain within various things? Are the senses involved at all, like vision and hearing, or is it more the recognition of face when you're talking of a face, things with it. So what's going on in the brain, our various brain differences perhaps?
Probably the short version of the question is, what parts of the brain are affected as you're watching the effects of meditation?
So the first thing that's important to point out is that meditation is kind of like the word sports. There are many different kinds of sports. Some of them are done solo, some of them are done in groups, some of them are more active, some are more passive. Same thing with meditation. There are literally hundreds of different kinds of practices. And anyone who tells you that there's a particular brain signature of meditation is excessively simplified. That's putting it diplomatically. There are, in the long-term practitioner, for example, we have studied, let me back up and say that there are basically three broad classes. Maybe I'll stand so people can see me. There are three broad classes of meditation types that are done as sitting practices. Some of these are also done in walking practices. But one we call focused attention practices, and this involves concentration. It could be concentration on an external stimulus or something internal. It could be concentration on an external object. It could be concentration on the breath. It could be concentration on a visualization. But those are all focused attention practices. A second kind of practice is called open monitoring. By open monitoring, we mean that there's not a singular focus of attention. The field of awareness is extremely broad. In the Tibetan tradition, the main type of meditation that this is identified with is Dzogchen. In the Theravadan tradition, it's Vipassana. And this is where there is not a single focus of attention. And so the practitioner is trained to essentially pay attention to a broad field of awareness, to the penumbra of awareness, and to focus on whatever the dominant component of consciousness might be. It might be a thought, in which case there would be a kind of non-evaluative observation of the thought. Oh, here's a thought. Here it goes. Or an emotion or a sensation in, for example, tingling or pain. So all that's under the category of open monitoring. The third broad class of meditation practice we call positive affect training. And the compassion practice that I talked about earlier is an example of positive affect training. It's a kind of training that is specifically designed to cultivate particular types of positive emotions. Each of those three practices involves very different patterns of brain activity. So there is not a common neural substrate that exists among all three, but they're all different. They all involve different parts of the brain. And I also should say that although I mentioned this one part of the brain, which is the insula is an interesting part of the brain because it is the only part of the brain that has a map of the body. It's got what we call a viscerotopic map of the body. So the visceral organs are mapped on the insula. And so one of the things that probably happens in compassion practice in particular is that you notice a lot of the sensations in your body, and the practitioner is often taught to notice the sensations around the heart, especially. And so it's not surprising that we see that the insula is particularly involved in compassion-type practices. But with focused attention practices, there's a whole network of brain regions that we know to be very involved in attention. And in open monitoring, the entire brain is involved, and we see very massive dynamic changes that occur in many different parts of the brain.
Yes, sir.
Going on beyond that a little bit, can you talk about the body a little, the energy fields and the relation of those? So, for instance, Tai Chi or Qigong, the meditative aspects of the movements there, which are moving energy in your body, or the chakras, and dwelling on those, how do those relate to the three kinds of meditation,
if you
work at all?
Question is, moving from the brain to the energy fields in the body and various kinds of movement practices, and how do those connect?
In terms of energy fields and entities like chakras, first of all, the kinds of meditation that involve manipulation of energy probably are more what we call focused attention, where there's concentration at specific places on the body. But the honest answer is scientists really have no idea what these energy fields are about. I'm certainly open to these things, and I've done certain practices that involve them, and I have experienced certain things as a practitioner that I would say are, you know, definitely interesting and unusual. But as a scientist, I have absolutely no idea what they're about. There is beginning to be some research, serious research that's being done on this. By and large, what has gone under the guise of research in this area has mostly been really not very well done research. For the very first time, there are more serious studies that are occurring. There are particularly good studies that are happening in the area of acupuncture. And to the extent that it's tapping into similar kinds of energy systems, that will be illuminating. But we're really at an extremely early stage of research, serious research in this area. And I think that, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how all this develops.
We're getting down to about the last 5 minutes here, so go over here first.
Biomedic and scientist. I'm frequently compelled to sit at my desk and contemplate the results of a complex experiment, and it may involve a great deal of time and different kinds of thought processes. Is any of that of value equivalent to meditation?
Is contemplating the results of an experiment have any equivalency with meditation? We're trying to figure out what's going on here, really focused on.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I'm sure that there are some similarities. I'm also sure that there are some differences. I think it's important that we be nuanced about making these comparisons. And so I'm confident that the component of focused attention is something that is very similar. In open monitoring meditation, when you are aware of a kind of broader field of awareness and the penumbra of awareness, I think it's very akin to some of the stages of scientific creativity when, you know, you're kind of aware of a number of different strands and you are trying to piece them together, and if you're lucky, they sometimes do come together. So I think that those are all components that are very much in common, and I think that through doing science, you can cultivate qualities like focused attention in very similar ways. What's different, though, is that some scientists do their science for the sake of eliminating suffering on the planet, but most scientists, I don't think, really have that as a motivation which is with them constantly. That is really something that's different, I think, about the contemplative traditions. Which I think is very important. But I can tell you anecdotally, I sometimes will have a period of meditation when I'm sitting to meditate, when I'm actively involved in a scientific problem, and I'll actually sometimes, I must confess, I have a little digital tape recorder that I put right by my meditation cushion, because what happens is that if I have an idea that pops up during meditation, sometimes I will get so fixated on the idea and worry about losing it, so this I just blurt it out and it gets recorded, and then I can go back to my meditation. And I'd say maybe 10% of the time there are really interesting ideas.
Try this very quickly. About the concentrated practice of people who become sports heroes. First of all, you've got competition involved in that, and a joy in basically defeating the other team or individual. So that's an issue. And when I look at persons who were sports heroes who went into politics, I don't see compassion, I don't see empathy. I see willingness to go along with force, intimidation, and violence with a lot of them, and I see that less with artists and musicians.
Summary is, in sports, the concentration tends to be focused on defeating someone else, And when people from sports move to politics, they don't often tend to act with compassion. There's a question.
Can I just say one anecdote? So one, Mathieu Ricard is one of the monks that we studied. Before he became a monk, he was actually a championship ping pong player. We have a ping pong table in our house that I used to play a lot of ping pong with my son with. And so Mathieu was staying with us one day, and he decided he wanted to try his hand at ping pong again. He hadn't played in like 30 years. And so there he is in his monk's robes. We're up on our third floor playing ping pong, and it turns out that he is a damn good player. And so he would slam the ball, and after each time he slammed the ball, he said, "Oh, I'm sorry.
My question is, have you done studies, or are you anticipating doing studies, relative to the peripheral biology, the effect of the mind on the peripheral biology, especially as it relates to serious illness?
You're doing studies on peripheral biology, and you might define for us non-scientists what peripheral biology is.
The rest of the body.
Peripheral biology is everything below the neck. That's what we call peripheral biology. I'm not sure what you really mean by serious illnesses. We are interested in the impact of meditation on the body. We are studying illnesses that are major public health concerns where there's documented evidence that psychosocial factors play some role in modulating the course of the illness, because that sort of provides a clue to us that the mind somehow is involved. And one of the illnesses that we've chosen, which might not be expected just reflecting on this casually, is asthma. It turns out that asthma is a huge public health concern. It is responsible for devastating suffering, particularly among members of low socioeconomic groups. So we've been studying how the brain and the mind impact lung function, and it is a wonderful model disorder for the potential application of contemplative practices in modulating the course of the illness. And it's not to suggest that they're going to replace medication or that they're going to be a cure, but I think that when used judiciously, these kinds of practices could really be helpful with patients who have these disorders, and certainly decrease the extent of medication that they're taking that has all kinds of toxic side effects.
We take one or two more.
As someone who's begun to study forgiveness and how it relates to post-traumatic stress disorder in the body, and also being a 25-year practitioner of massage therapy and body work, I'm wondering what you think about the concept that the brain is not just the organ that you're studying in the head, but that the brain is actually the entire body.
The question about the concept of whether the brain is more than just an organ in the head, but is in effect the entire body.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it. And, you know, our brains are embodied, our minds are embodied, and you can't think about the brain without also thinking about the body. I wouldn't quite go so far as to say that the whole body is the brain, but I do. There's another anecdote that I'll describe. One of the times that I was visiting the Dalai Lama in India, he asked if I would give a talk to the monks at the Namgyal Monastery, which is the monastery connected to his residence in Dharamsala, India. And there are all these young monks there, you know, the average age is like 16 or 17. They've had very little exposure to science at the time that I gave this talk. Since then, they've actually been much more heavily exposed to Western science as a function of the Dalai Lama. One of the things that I thought would be interesting is we'd actually give a demonstration of recording brain activity. And we had some equipment with us, so we put on a funny electrode cap on one of us to record brain activity. And we actually showed them on a computer monitor. And when we put on this cap, the entire audience, there are about 200 monks in the audience, they just burst out laughing. I mean, totally cracking up. And they started, it was 5 minutes of continuous laughter. And we thought that they were laughing at how funny this guy looks with the electrode cap on. It turns out that they're laughing at us because we're putting our sensors on the head instead of putting them on the heart. That was what they were laughing about. It took us a while to figure all that out with the translation. But, you know, I think it underscores your point, which I think is a very important one. And all I could say is it's just a terrifically rich and complicated area of inquiry, and it's really just started. So there's a lot to look forward to.
There's one more question over here.
I was going to ask you, so would you recommend that each of us meditate for 2 hours a day?
You know, I would recommend that you start slow. Don't be too ambitious. Bite off small chunks. I think it's very unrealistic for most people to meditate 2 hours a day. But I don't think it's at all unrealistic for most people to meditate for a short amount of time every day.
And so even,
you know, any amount helps.
5 minutes?
5 minutes would be better than nothing. And if you did 5 minutes, what I would say is do it several times a day. You know, I lead an incredibly busy life, and I manage to carve out time for it every day. And, you know, people always tell me, well, they're really busy and how are they going to do it? And 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, once you begin to taste the fruits of it, I think you'll want to do it more because you'll see that it can make a difference. And so I would say don't be overly ambitious because you'll get frustrated at how hard it is. And anyone who tells you that meditation is always relaxing hasn't really done it. It's not always relaxing. It can generate some agitation, but that will all work itself out in the process, and eventually there'll be equanimity. But I'd recommend that you try it. I think it is really important for the health of our minds and our brains, and it will impact our culture, I think, in very positive ways. If our political leaders did 5 minutes of compassion meditation a day, I think the world would be a different place.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here.